Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today, we're so happy to have back with us the most diligent learner I've ever met, the one, the only, Lorraine Davies. Lorraine, thanks for joining us once again.
Oh, truly, truly my pleasure. My pleasure. So wonderful
It's wonderful to have you. And we got through our technological difficulties. Hopefully we make it through a full podcast. You're in Australia and we're here in California. But I know you got to come out and visit us at LMU in Georgia. And it was your first trip to the U.S. and maybe your first time around volleyball teams and in the gym with volleyball players. What were some of your first impressions?
Truly, and in both universities, the eagerness to learn, which has been my inspiration to come back next year, is absolute eager to learn. There wasn't any, I'm not buying that, or it was just, they'll check that out, and just that eager to learn. And everyone was so kind and welcoming and just could not have been nicer. And not once did I bump up against the I don't know if I believe that, or it was just
playing,
like,
the piano.
Oh, you'd think so.
I'm not sure yet.
Now I've got Siri on there. Oh, what a time! Oh my goodness. It was just inspirational for me. It truly was. I've talked so much about America to people here and educators, to the degree that the next two schools I'm fully embedding this work, it was I really came back with an attitude of, unless you're going to take this into your own being as teachers and parents, there's absolutely no point in us starting. And thankfully they said, okay, we're scared, but we're up for it. So that's great.
We learned so much from you. Discussing and using all the tactics and all the things we learned from you. And that's why we wanted to have you back on and get into some of the things that we discussed. So I don't know, Billy, you want to start us off?
Yeah, we're going to jump right into some talk on autonomy. So Lorraine, could you start off by defining autonomy for us?
Certainly. What I would like to say first is to just make an alert that autonomy is barely considered or understood, if at all, in our roles as parents, coaches, and teachers. And a lack of autonomy is so much behind relationship breakdown, regardless of age, gender, or IQ. So I was really eager to convey that our autonomy, that doesn't concern us. It concerns everyone on this planet. So just to what is autonomy, it can be defined as the ability to make choices according to one's own free will. And that's not attitudinal. That's something that we're hardwired into. So autonomy is related to freedom of choice, and it corresponds to our ability to decide for ourselves based on presented alternatives. So when we just say, this is what you're doing, do it, we can set up a threat response. But when we offer possibilities and options, we set up we then invoke that sense of autonomy. So our need to make choices freely is critical to our mental health and well-being. Hence, I was saying at the start, this applies to everyone, and it's really quite important. So if we feel coerced or even by an internal pressure like guilt or shame or external pressures from other people, our feeling of autonomy is under threat. And I'll be going into that a little bit deeper as we go forward. And sometimes choices are 100% in the hands of a coach, teacher, or a parent, and they're dictated by constraints, particularly in sports. But by offering choices that tie in with constraints, our need to make a choice is satisfied. And I'll just very briefly say, we can easily relate to children reading a story at night. And if it's late, they've had a big day and they're tired and they choose a lengthy book, it's highly likely that a parent will say no. But if we offer a child a choice of three short stories that we've selected, their need for choice is satisfied. So autonomy is achieved even if it's only perceived. And lacking autonomy leads to dissatisfaction and frustration, but lack of purpose. And this is important for adults because that often leads to burnout, and it's presumed to be a result of overwork or lack of support. However, the research shows that the single most significant cause of work burnout is not work overload, but working too long without experiencing our own personal development, which comes with lack of autonomy.
Why would you say we crave autonomy? Can you go more into that? Why we want this?
Okay. I'll open up a little bit more as to the brain connection of this as we move along. But we crave it because not only is it our most basic need, it's innate. We're born with it. We arrive with it. And that in itself is enough to say this is very important. And in another moment, I'll refer to the threat response, but not right now. I'll refer to the reward response, because when we experience autonomy, we experience the reward response, which is that we're in control, even if it's only perceived, but we're very confident that all's going the way we need it to go. And that releases dopamine. And increased levels of dopamine leads to feelings of satisfaction and pleasure and confidence. And the dopamine reinforcement increases the likelihood that we'll repeat the behavior. So when we as coaches and parents are providing our athletes and kids with that, with autonomy, we know we've got that ongoing buildup of dopamine. And so they repeat the behavior. So it's our need to make choices is crucial for our well-being. And again, research shows and studies confirm that when our need for autonomy is satisfied, making choices, being self-directed, we feel more interested, engaged, and happy. And again, think of dopamine. However, if our need for autonomy is thwarted or actively frustrated, we feel more alienated, helpless, sometimes even hostile, which then inculcates the threat response. So to satisfy our need for autonomy, we need to be offered choices, reasonable choices, and the opportunity for self-direction. The micromanagement is the antithesis of autonomy. So the key to happiness at work for us as adults isn't money, it's greater autonomy.
Lorraine, can you go deeper into what happens when we feel coerced?
Oh, absolutely, because here we really hit the threat response. So the threat response or the reward response, again, it's the overarching organizing principle of our brain. It's all organizing according to that. So we move away from threat and we move towards reward. So we need to create the environment for that. And as I said, our need for autonomy is a powerful, innate driver. As with all things innate, it's there to keep us safe, to keep us alive. So imagine feeling forced to do things, even if you wanted to do them, if you weren't being forced to do them. I don't know if I've said that right, but can you guys relate? When someone tells you what to do, we tend to pull away like, no, sure. It's just an inner response. But I want you to know that attitude isn't driving those feelings, and it's often attributed to someone having a bad attitude. Those feelings are associated with being coerced, are brain-driven. And so autonomy is linked to our brain's number one prime directive, and that is to survive. Survival to ensure our genes survive, our ongoing lineage. And that drive is as real today as it was tens of thousands of years ago. So whether a physical threat or a psychological effect, feeling shamed, humiliated, we behave in predictable ways throughout the world. And the threat responses we really are quite aware of is fight, flight, freeze, or faint. So when we have our need to make choices, to self-determine is when that's removed, when we're imposed upon by either a person or an authority, we feel less safe and more anxious. And it's not for nothing that the levels of anxiety are going through the roof in the world. So again, being micromanaged or feeling coerced can easily trigger the threat response. So when we're experiencing a lack of control or threat to our sense of agency, our perception of uncertainty, this is feeling not safe, is raised, and that raises our stress levels. I'll go in further a little bit long with what that does to our body and brain. So as teachers and coaches and parents, we need to understand how easily we trigger that threat, and we're not even aware that we're doing it by not providing reasonable choices and self-direction. But by contrast, the perception of greater autonomy increases the feeling of certainty and thus reduces stress. So we adults who want to support learners' need for autonomy must give latitude to make choices. And this is really important, regardless of age, gender, or IQ, and particularly around age. Never too young, never too small.
So what are some studies on autonomy? And could you share some of those? And can you share what the research shows through these studies?
Certainly, there are many studies, and they all say the same thing, that there are studies in many different fields, and they do come out the same way. A particular one that I've spoken about in presentations is by Roden and Langer, and they conducted a study in a nursing home for the elderly on the effects of choice and enhanced personal responsibility. So there were two groups, excuse me, this was in an actual nursing home, and the group that were on level one, they were given they all lived in their own room, and they were given the freedom to make choices, to organise their room in the way they wanted. They had a choice of a plant and however many plants, but they had the responsibility for caring for the plant. So there was no staff making decisions for them, and the resident, they took care of the plant. Everything was done by the resident and not by the staff, except the nursing requirements, clearly. And then in group two, they had no autonomy whatsoever. The staff were fully responsible and made all the choices and decisions on the resident's behalf. And the outcome was that the researchers stated, I'll just read this quote, residents who were given more control over decision-making lived longer and healthier lives than residents in the control group who had everything done for them. See, the choices themselves were less significant. It was the perception of autonomy that mattered. And I applaud that study because there would be many people, I would suggest, would say, oh, that wouldn't work in what we do. But when you consider running a nursing home and the medicines and all those sorts of things, but they clearly identified they had to be giving the residents there, quite elderly, choice and responsibility, and they did much, much better.
Cool. I guess to turn the question towards us and say, how does it apply to what we do? In competition, where it's very stressful, some people would think that being told what to do is something the players would want. But how can autonomy really help in those stressful situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll get to that. And competition certainly is very stressful. But competition is less stressful to the brain than the threat response to the brain. And these are things we've never had to take into account as parents, coaches, and teachers, but we really need to. So again, going back to our primary goal is to predict where and how we can avoid threats and gain rewards, because our brain seeks to make accurate predictions. It has an aversion to uncertainty. So because our brain seeks certainty, it values autonomy. This is the sense of being in control of circumstances, our destiny. And we feel stressed when we perceive a threat or potentially threatening circumstances that we're not able to control. And yet it's just, excuse me, some people want to be told what to do, but my bias is such that people are the end result of not having experienced autonomy, not having developed a sense of agency either in the past or currently. And having learned compliance, this is they've not learned to think, not to contribute, not they've learned not to think, not to contribute, and not to question. They've learned to merely go along with. As life experience has taught them, their input, their thinking, it just wasn't wanted, and it certainly wasn't valued, and it definitely was not regarded. And that's not to infer they aren't people going along with having everything being told what to do. That doesn't mean that they're not consistently being triggered into the threat response. I can remember a conversation by email, Billy, that you and I had around this. Do you remember that?
Yeah, as a coach, when your autonomy is taken away.
Yes, with tennis balls, I think it was, if I remember right.
Yeah, in my situation, I had a club director saying every practice he wanted us to have the players do approaches and throw tennis balls over the net to work on wrist snap. It was something for me that I didn't really believe in, and I would never have my players do. And so it felt at odds, I guess, to be going through the motions and having them do this when it wasn't something I agreed with.
And so how did you feel as a coach?
I felt.
What did you do with it?
Kind of boxed in, and I think we did it the one practice, and then when I didn't think it was of any value, I just stopped doing it.
So you ignored it.
Yeah.
And that's a really good one to rest on for a moment, because we assume, because we're the adults talking to teenagers or children, is that they're taking it all in, thinking it's pretty schmicko. But in fact, they could be thinking, "What? This is irrelevant. This has no purpose for me. You're just bossing me." And without any awareness, is that they're not intrigued and in awe of our wisdom. And I think it shows up a lot there with teenagers. And that teenagers, it's a crucial, crucial, crucial time in their development that they really step out and be autonomous. And you guys are too young, but I can remember when my children grew into teenagers and I would buy fabulous things for them and to be wondering why they never worn. Is because they resist so strongly that need to be a carbon copy of an adult. It has to be, this is me, I'm exploring me. And I've heard parents say of their teenagers, "You used to be such a lovely boy or girl," and that's code for compliance, by the way, saying, "You accepted everything I said and everything I chose for you." And it's so important that we feel that pushback and we let them to explore how they need to develop into people, but to give them autonomy. And the competition of sports will not impact on the athletes like the stress on their brain will impact on them.
Lorraine, are there times where coach wants to be direct and say, "Yeah, this is what you should do"? And when are those times where we can, yeah, I guess not in a forceful way, but give direction?
And that's a tricky one again. It comes back to, and I've said from day one, John, is that language is power. It's all, the brains are shaped by the language in the environment, because the language creates the threat or the reward response. But that is something that coaches have to be working together. That's not something, because I don't have coach language, but it is something of observing and working together as a group, of identifying language that is so direct and forceful, or language that says, "We're going to try this and we're going to try this. Tell me what you think about it," is still bringing in autonomy. It doesn't mean, it's, as I said, it can just be perceived. It's not to say this is literal, but it's as long as that the athletes involved have a sense of their involvement, input, their thinking, which is why I advocate always for athletes to give feedback to a coach or a parent, anybody. It's how it's done. This is where I'd really encourage you to work as a group to identify how you can set that up, how you can do it. We're going to get to directive statements in a little while, about, and that's around language, and maybe that will come up. You will see that there.
Yeah, no, I think we will. Yeah, definitely with the feedback stuff. I'm glad. I think that was a really valuable clarification. I'm glad you hashed that out a little bit. That makes a lot of sense. So as we go into how the brain responds on a chemical level to autonomy.
Great question. Great question. Because it's all happening at a chemical level. So again, to repeat, that the threat or reward response is the overarching principle of the brain. It's involuntary. It's subconscious. It's innate. We're born with it. And we each have that drive. There's no one missing out on that. And again, that organizes our brain. So when we lack autonomy, the threat response occurs. And here's the tricky bit. Our brain possesses 5 times as many threat circuits as reward circuits. And then when we consider the brain is geared for a bias toward negativity to keep us alive, that clearly is easily tipped, readily tipped into the threat response. And just to take a moment, when I'm presenting this information, it really is amazing that we're all surviving in terms of our relationships. And maybe this is where, when we understand this chemical level, the threat reward response, the need for autonomy, our relationships will be more harmonious. Because when we have that threat response, that sets up the stress chemical cortisol, a neurotransmitter, and it's a hormone associated with fight, flight, freeze, or faint response. And because I said before, our ancient system's number one function is our prime directive is to survive, and it will override all else. And again, releasing cortisol into the system is really, really damaging to our health on a very serious level. So a threat, whether actual or perceived, to our sense of fairness, safety, security, reputation, or trust, that activates the threat response. And that, as I was saying before, when you have a group and how you set up these conversations, it's there's a sense of fair play is powerfully important for people to feel. I might not like it, but it's fair or it's reasonable. You'll get greater engagement. But just going to a decrease in autonomy, so when there's an increase in autonomy, that triggers the reward response in the brain. So that releases dopamine, and this is where we want to be, which encourages our brain to work at optimal levels, optimal levels. And you may have found that just as suggesting to an athlete or a coach or a parent, let me give you some feedback, that can trigger the threat response, and it's an involuntary response. If a person's having some sense of inadequacy or you're going to tell me bad things, just saying that. So how we're shaping our language is really important. But the more dopamine that we're experiencing, the greater our functioning and our health as well. So it's no more so than if the culture hasn't normalized growth mindset characteristics for all, again, regardless of age, gender, or IQ. So if we're cultivating a culture of growth mindset, there's less of a threat response because our culture suggests any mistake, any feedback is just about taking us to a new level of learning. It's not a criticism or a threat. And more and more, I find teachers are losing their autonomy in teaching practice where an athlete and coaches too, perhaps, when they're forced to implement outmoded 20th century practices that are unable to support learners when there's no understanding of what's happening in the learners' brains and how they function and why they function in particular ways.
So I have a more volleyball-specific question. And yeah, if it doesn't make sense, just let me know. So a very common thing in volleyball is when there's a server back at to start the play. That's how every play starts, with a serve. Can you picture that?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so before they serve, very, very typically a coach will give the player a number, and that number means where they're supposed to serve.
Yep.
They'll just show them a number, and they're supposed to serve that part. The number signifies which part of the court they're supposed to serve. It's kind of a quick interaction. So I'm trying to think of a way how could a coach add autonomy to this situation where time is a little bit limited, you're not really able to talk to them, and you want to give them direction on where to put their serve? Any ideas?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not about where they're going to serve to, but did you call that the server?
Yes.
Yeah, and again, does that work for you? What would work better for you? Do you see what I mean? It's putting it back to that, no, that's fine. Or, look, could you do this? And then there's autonomy in action.
Okay, so it's how you say it.
Well, and it always comes back to how I say it. You might still repeat exactly the same words, but by taking the athlete into account, you're giving them the learning and the experience of this applies to you so much and we're relying on you, so what works best for you of how I can indicate that to you.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Again, we worry a lot as to what to say or how to say it, but if we just ask the person what works for you, we're a long way in front of all ages, and I mean even little children. What works for you?
The interaction of like holding up a finger to give a serving signal is pretty quick, but I would think that even with, I guess, the body language of how you do it could influence, like if it was like a strict, like number one, like do this, serve here, versus like more like a raised eyebrow, can you hit the spot? Does this sound good? Like almost like a question to the server, like a challenge, or like, hey, does this work for you? I think that could even be different.
Yes, because anything that has a question means you're involving another party. Follow what I say, as opposed to does this whatever for you. They've got a role to play, and that's feeling inclusion, and we know that inclusion or being ostracized, that shows up in a pain area of the brain when the person experiences that. So it's all incredibly important, and we need to be that inclusive and not just barking an instruction.
Cool.
Even though it's not intended that way.
Right. Well, let's move into feedback. Can you give us some examples of productive feedback?
Well, I will. I'd just like to say first off, though, that tell a student the most common ones, which is great job, or this needs work, is a missed opportunity, because telling me what I did great or how to improve my work, where's the information telling me what my next steps are? If I don't know what I did was great, it's just a missed opportunity, because for me, every interaction is having an impact on the learner, their brain, their well-being. So we need to maximize that to make it effective. And because there's so much fluff, we've developed a habit of that. So since learning is a process, productive feeding must be productive feedback, it has to be ongoing. And so to be productive, it needs to be on time and in real time. None of this, I'll get back to you later about that. And so when is feedback the wrong time? And that's only ever when it's too late, when it's not in real time. And the optimal time is real time, in order the learner can, or the athlete or anyone, can put it into place immediately. And so it's not hard to see where the good job, awesome, fantastic, there's no feedback on there if that can be implemented. When there's a struggle going on, even though there's been really big effort put in to say, she's having something like, you're acknowledging what they've done, so in their process. So it's okay, so you didn't do as well as you wanted to. Let's look at this as an opportunity to learn. Again, it takes a little longer than the good job. Or what learning strategies are you using? What skills are you applying? Let's try something different. It's giving them where they can take that next. And that's productive feedback. If there's a lacking of a specific skill and there's a need for improvement, give it a try. We can always fix mistakes once we see where you're getting held up. These things are taking the learner further. So when we're another one when they've put in really big effort, and it's not just about congratulating on effort, but it's then identifying that, congratulations, you use really great strategies for managing your time, self-regulating, whatever else it might be. And another one I would say is, I want you to remember for a moment how challenging this was when you began. Look how far you've come. So this is at when you see this effort being really applied. However, success without effort is, so you can imagine success with strong effort, good job, or a success without much effort, good job, looks ridiculous when you're saying, it looks like you're putting in much effort. Is this the way you see it? Because then we bring the learner into that conversation, because they know if they're not. If not, what is it that you are doing and how can I help you with new strategies? So it's a way of calling out not much effort is going in, or how can we grow your development in that area, or to make your whatever even better, and then we can put into two processes that they can put in place. So instead of good job, we see your second serve was particularly strong. Wonder if you'd be interested in talking to about your... It's just ways that we're taking them further if every word that comes out of their mouth. Because for me, my guru of feedback is John Hattie, and his criteria is, unless we're telling our learners, how am I doing, answering their innate questions, how am I doing, where am I going, and what are my next steps, it's more likely to end up fluff, being interpreted, you're picking on me, you don't like me, all that kind of thing. But we have to have that effective language in place. And I've shared these with you before about, it's not about being good but getting better. It's not about proving but improving. It's not about demonstrating skills but developing skills. And not performing better than others but performing better than you did in the past. And I must say, I find it disconcerting for different sports I'll check out on the internet. And the focus really is, we're the best, we're the winners, and it's about performance, not about ongoing and ongoing.
That was part one of our conversation with Lorraine Davies. Join us next week as we talk more about autonomy and feedback.